Well, good morning. It's good to be with you. If you're online, we're so glad that you've joined us. If you're in the room, make some noise. Let them know that you're here in a room. Yeah. Yeah, it is fun to see so many of you, meet so many of you, for some of you, most of you for the first time. Again, I got here about 6 weeks before the pandemic hit, and so thank you for trusting me at the North Campus with the guy you didn't know, except for on a screen. Really appreciate you. Thank you to John, Kathy, for trusting Libby and I to lead this campus, especially when the chaos hit. But, you know, as we're in this series, you know, I want to remind you, if you've heard before, if you haven't, and to cast a little vision about this series, which is how to simplify life. And a lot of times we see a series like how to simplify life and we think, oh, they're going to give me like three easy steps to like change my entire life, right? We are not going to do that in this series. How we're going to help you simplify is helping you take a look back. How you were maybe raised, history, your family of origin, which John did a great job last week on. This week we're going to talk about, the title of it is called The Tooth Fairy. The Tooth Fairy. And what did we believe? And what was it about our innocence that we believed, but that all of a sudden shifted in a moment where innocence was lost? And there's this thing going on online. If you're online, if you're hanging out on social media or hanging out on whatever, there's this thing called, I was today years old when I found out blank. Right? People are sharing stories. I didn't know that most people think is common knowledge is somebody's like, I had no idea that's what that was. They're finding out the real lyrics to a song. They're finding out what that tool was really meant for. They're finding out all these things because in our families, we were taught how to use that tool. In our families, our parents sang that song a particular way. In our family, the way we were raised, our community, our context, and yet you become 25, 35, 45, 55, 65, 75, and you start relearning some of the things you thought were true. I will tell you, I know most of you probably already know this, I had no idea that as a kid, I was being terrorized and just kept up at night because of Michael Myers in the Halloween movies. And it wasn't Michael Myers, it was actually William Shatner. You may not know this, but the mask used in the Halloween movies, the producers went out down the street and picked up a William Shatner mask and painted it white. I was kept up at night by Star Trek. Not Halloween, right? Because we have these things like, oh my gosh, my mind is blown. I thought it was this great, crazy character. No, it was William Shatner mask painted white. And we have these things that happen, and sometimes they're trivial. Sometimes they're funny. But then there are other times, man, they really get us. Like, I'm not going to go too far on this because I don't want to get too many emails, but maybe your trauma was around Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. Or the Tooth Fairy. Matter of fact, our youth pastor at South, Ricky Etchiona, he tells a story of being a kid and he was, you know, going to places he shouldn't go, your parents' drawer, and he found all of his teeth. And he was freaked out. Either my parents are serial killers or there is no, you know who. And so we have these moments that really allow us to understand, oh, I'm no longer 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And we have these moments that push the fast forward button. And it moves us forward older to experience things that maybe we weren't really ready to experience, or maybe things we should not have experienced at all. Because maybe these truths were life altering. Maybe it was the day you found out who your real dad was. And you were 25 years old and somebody kept it from you. Yeah, maybe it was the day you found out your mom had cancer and you were 11 years old and now you're gonna go through your teenage years without a mother. Yeah, maybe it's the first time you face sexism. You went through middle school and high school and you were a great athlete or you were smart and it didn't matter if you were a girl, you wanted to be an engineer or you wanted to go into science, and then you get out in the world and nobody's giving you a shot. And the reality is, or maybe it's the first time you face racism. I remember the first time I faced racism. My parents tried to prepare me for the world. I was in third grade and I had a crush on a girl named Cresta. (Laughs) And Cresta was the prettiest girl in our school. And Cresta and I would flirt as little third graders. And we would hold hands and we would do our thing. And an older girl named Rebecca, who was a fifth grader, because, you know, fifth graders rule elementary school, she came up to me and Cresta one day. She goes, "You guys can't like each other because you're Mexican." And I remember thinking, I really want to hit you right now, but I shouldn't. So I pushed her in the mud. Of course, I'm the one who got suspended from school. And I told my parents about this, and my parents were just like, "Listen, God created you the way you are, and there's no such thing as a mistake in God's eyes. He created you." And my parents did a great job of parenting, but I remember it woke me up. Third grade. And then there's the trauma of finding out. 1 in 3 women, 1 in 4 men, you find out that the adults in your life maybe don't have your best interests at heart. Because at least 1 in 3 women, at least 1 in 4 men are victims of physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. And somebody invaded, literally invaded your life. Somebody came into your room and literally robbed you of your innocence. It wasn't about a character. It wasn't about a cartoon. It wasn't about some fun fact in the world. It was that evil entered your bedroom one night. It changed your life forever. And I remember when I heard these stats, I thought, there's no way, because I am one of those. And I've shared my story before. I am a victim of sexual abuse, and it was through people that were close to my family. It wasn't my family. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, there's more of us? I spent my whole childhood thinking I was the only one. And then I'm in training to be a pastor, and you start hearing these statistics of, no, it's 1 in 4 guys. 1 in 3 ladies, at the very least. And now I'm like looking, who is like me? Who has been through what I've been through? Who understands that my life was robbed from me as a kid? And what I rarely share is that it wasn't just one time. What actually happened was I was a victim of sexual abuse by 3 different men as a child. And how can I stand here all these years later, 36 years later, from the time it first began, how can I stand here in full confidence, knowing that God is with me, knowing that I'm healed and continue to walk in healing? How can I do that? I do it because it's not my life. I do it because I surrendered. And that's what we're going to walk through today. How is it that we face these things that burst the proverbial childhood bubble, and yet you remain standing somehow? And maybe it's barely standing, but you're here. And what we want from you as a church is not just to exist in your pain, but to allow the pain to then be a foundation for something greater than your pain. So we're walking you through family, reparenting yourself, telling truth where there were lies. Because if you think about it, what would we want for our children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews and family members? What would we want to do for them? Psalm 82 actually gives us advice on what to do when people are facing these kinds of things. It says, defend the weak and the fatherless. Uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed. Rescue the weak and the needy and deliver them from the hand of the wicked. Some of you had things happen to you that were wicked. It didn't just stink. It wasn't just a bad experience. It was evil incarnate. And yet God's calling us to defend the weak. And then how do we heal? How do we grow from the trauma of innocence lost? Psalm 91 is this poetic verse about really resting in God. It says, he will cover you with his pinions. And bird lovers know what pinions are. They're a part of the wing. Right? A wing. And under his wings, you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and buckler. You will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that stalks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. See, when we really allow ourselves to not try to be so strong, Because many of us have had to be strong to survive. When we allow ourselves to be under God's covering, there's a healing that begins to take place. Now, I really want to be clear and manage your expectations. One weekend service, one series at Gateway, or a series of messages at Gateway isn't going to bring you complete healing. But maybe, just maybe, a series or a message will prick your heart and help you take a step that not only acknowledges the trauma that you and I have potentially faced, but knowing that God walks with us and brings healing, and that he's been with us the entire time. And it causes us all sorts of questions, which we're going to get to here in the passage. We're going to go to Judges chapter 6, or beginning in chapter 6. And it's the story of Gideon. And if you don't know the story of Gideon, Gideon was a nobody. No name, no family name. He wasn't a prince. He wasn't in line for anything. He was the lowest of the low, and that's what he calls himself. And yet God has this knack for raising up people out of obscurity and asking them to go with confidence to take on an overwhelming challenge, to defeat an entire army. And that's what he asked Gideon to do. You're a nobody, you have nothing, but I'm gonna raise you up and I want you to go and you're gonna defeat the enemy that is in front of you. And Gideon had thousands of people and God whittled it down to 300. Gideon was the original 300. God has a way of doing things, and it sounds straight out of a movie, like a movie script, where like this guy is a nobody and gets raised up and he's this warrior and God calls him a mighty warrior and he goes and he defeats an army. And people love that story. But we're not gonna focus on the war. We're not gonna focus on the victory. We're gonna focus on the process that God walks him through to become the warrior that God knew him to be. We're gonna go back to the very beginning of this interaction between Gideon, this nobody, and a God who shows up to him. So here we go, starting in verse 12. And when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Gideon says, "Pardon me, my Lord? But if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us?" Anybody ever asked that question? If you're really with me, why has all this happened? Where are all his wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, "Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt and out of slavery?" But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of the Midianites, their enemy. Verse 14, the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in strength. Go in the strength that you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" And Gideon, he's still not believing it. He's like, "Pardon me? Excuse me? But how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I am the least in my family." The Lord answered, "I will be with you." Now, what can we learn about these initial interactions between Gideon and God? And listen, a lot of us in the room are just starting this relationship with God. And some of us in the room and many of us online, we haven't even committed to God. We're just trying to figure this whole thing out, and that's okay. This is a great place for you to figure that out, because we're all trying to figure it out. Whether it's John as our lead pastor last week, me leading our executive team, leading North, we're still trying to figure it out, people. We just want you to be part of the journey with us. So what can we learn? Number one, God sees clearly. So, you know, when I put these on, I was in fourth or fifth grade the first time I had to wear glasses, and I hated it. I still hate it. I'm 44 years old, and I cannot keep them on. I always do this. I take them off, I put them on, I lose them. I'm the guy who buys 5 pairs of glasses and puts one in my car, one in my office. I'm that guy. And some of you who are really big cheapskates, you're like, just, you know, track them. Keep them on your face. But I don't, because I really don't need them for everyday interaction. But if I need to see something clearly, if I'm watching my beloved but awful Chicago Bears on the television, if I'm watching basketball, if I'm watching my kids do something incredible, I always want to put on my glasses because I want to see the thing I care about very clearly. I don't want just a mirage of what I care about. I want to see it in details. My daughter joined band. I'm a band dad now. This is really weird after having a jock for my oldest kid who was like all-state football player. And then I have my second daughter just graduated high school and she's like a high school princess. She's like, everybody loves her. And then my third kid's like, I'm playing band. I'm in the band. I don't want to be like all those other kids. I want to be in band. Well, we live in Leander and Leander is like the place you want to live for music. These kids are out there 8 hours a day. I can't go outside for 30 minutes. 8 hours a day, and they're learning dance moves while they're playing. They're laying on the ground. They're doing all these things. So when I go see my daughter, and I see all that she's doing, and I see my investment, because nobody told me it costs more to do band than football, by hundreds of dollars. I had to ask John Burke for a loan. Like, are you kidding me? It's band. Yeah, but this is Leander band. It's still banned, people. So when I see my investment and I see my daughter who I love very much, and I see her out there, I don't just show up and just see some mirage of a little kid. No, I put on my glasses because I want to see the thing I care about do what she loves doing and she's really good at. And I want to see her clearly. The good thing about God is God doesn't need help with his vision. He already sees clearly. You're not a mistake. What you went through is not a mistake. God is with you, and he sees exactly what he needs to see. So verse 11, here we have, the angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak at Ophrah. We'll skip on, where he sees Gideon threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. He's in hiding to thresh the wheat because the Midianites are taking all of their food. So he's hiding. He's away. He's not out in the open, yet God goes and finds him in the secret place. How many times are we hiding and God finds a way to try to find us? And when the angel of the Lord appeared again, he said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. He's not a warrior. There's nothing about Gideon that tells us he has experience leading an army. There's nothing about Gideon's family line that tells us he should be a warrior. There's nothing about Gideon that has the accolades and the trophies of having fought wars. And yet God looks at him and calls him a warrior while he's hiding from the enemy. But this has not stopped God from calling out the greatness in Gideon. And God has a knack for doing this. I mean, he uses Rahab, a prostitute, to be part of Jesus' lineage. He used David, the youngest of his family, the shepherd boy that was overlooked by his own father, to be a king. And then he uses the disciples, these men who were living in the margins. They were fishermen. They were nobodies in society, and yet Jesus called them out. And then he uses his own son, Jesus. He was born in a manger in Nazareth, a place that nobody really went to. He didn't have a grand entry. And God has a way of using normalcy and those who were living in the margins and those of us who maybe had our bubbles burst and it pushed us over to where maybe we are unseen and our hurts are unseen and the way we've lived, we've been unseen, and yet God sees you and he sees you clearly. See, the problem isn't that God can see clearly. The problem is that we cannot see clearly. And if we can't see clearly for our own lives, can we truly see clearly for the lives we are in charge of? Our children, nieces, nephews, spouses. Do we truly see clearly who they are if we have no way to see clearly who we are? So what's the question that I want us to ask ourselves as parents, as spouses, as people who care for others? Do I clearly see the gifts, the talents, the blind spots and opportunities for my children and those I am charged to love? Do you see the gift of your spouse? I know it's hard to do that. Listen, this last week, I wish I could tell you that Libby and I had a great week. We actually had a pretty good week, except for we introduced for three nights in a row IKEA furniture. You know what that means? We didn't talk for three nights. There are moments you have that, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about moments of disagreement, moments you don't see eye to eye, or moments you want your way. I'm talking about, Do you have a lifestyle truly seeing that person for who they really are? And it's hard to do that when maybe you haven't seen or nobody has seen you for who you really are. And yet God sees Gideon that way and he sees us that way. God sees clearly. The second thing we learn is that God is near. He can see clearly because God is near. Verse 13, Gideon says, "Pardon me, my Lord, but if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are the wonders that our ancestors told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?'" It didn't feel very near. "But now the Lord has abandoned us, given us into the hands of the Midianites." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you?" God's trying to raise him up and encourage him. And then again, he goes, are you kidding me? How? If I don't feel safe, how am I safe to bring others to safety? In verse 16, the Lord answered, "I will be with you and you will strike down all of the Midianites." And I was asking myself this question: what kind of pain and wounds and trauma did Gideon have to be carrying for God himself to show up to him and him still not be able to fully embrace that God is with him? What kind of trauma did he have to be facing for there to be a love so great right in front of him and yet he couldn't receive it? How many of you have had somebody that you loved you and cared for you and wanted just to be with you? Maybe they asked you to marry you. Maybe that was you found a love you'd never had, an earthly love, but because of your trauma, you rejected them because you didn't know how to embrace it. What kind of trauma was Gideon facing? Maybe it was abandonment, fear, self-doubt. He wasn't in the emotional, spiritual, and mental space to even hear that God had called him a warrior. And yet God was near, and all he was promising was, "I will be with you. I'm going to be with you." My daughter, one of my daughters, she has a fear of throwing up. She's like afraid of it. And when she was little, she'd get sick and you're like, "Hey, your body wants to let that out." And she would just cry and sob and fall on the floor. And I remember one night, and she tells a story to her friends. One night we go to the bathtub and I said, "Hey, babe, listen, I know you're afraid of doing this, but you ate something and your body wants to get rid of it." And I'm walking through it. Some of you are gagging right now. Okay. And she's on her knees and I'm rubbing her back. And I said, "If you'll just relax, I'm with you. It's going to be okay." This happened probably 10 times when she was a kid. And every time you could see her body from going tense, fighting it. And she'd just relax. And I won't make any of the noises. And she would let it come out. And then we'd wipe her up and clean her up. And she didn't want to look at me. She's like, "Oh, I smell, I stink." And I'm just, as her dad, just with her, because I saw her find relief. And I wasn't afraid of any of the other stuff. And here she is now 18 years old, and she remembers that her dad was with her in one of the scariest moments when she was 5 and 6 years old. Do you know that's what God wants? He knows the junk you need to let out. He says, "Hey, I'm going to hold your hair. I'm going to be with you. I can't make it come out, though, but I can be here when you let it." Because he's near. And the question on this one is this: as a parent, as a person who cares for others, is this: am I present with my children and those I am charged to love? Am I fully present with my children? Now, growing up, it was very normal for my parents and my abuelitas, my grandmothers, to sing songs in English, especially hymns. And then they would translate them into Spanish. And as I was writing this message, this song literally came to my mind. It was a song by Merle Haggard. You're surprised I know who Merle Haggard is. It was written by Austin Miles in 1912, but Merle Haggard sang in 1981. And it's a beautiful song, beautiful hymn. He says, "I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on roses. And the voice I hear falling in my ear, or on my ear, the Son of God discloses. He speaks and the sounds of his voice is so sweet. The birds hush their singing and the melody that he gave to me within my heart is ringing. And my grandmother would sing, and he walks with me and he talks with me. He tells me I am his own. And the joy we share as we tarry there, none other have ever known. But I knew a song was making a difference in my grandmother's when they sung it in Spanish, because they didn't even know what it meant in English. And when they would sing it like, El conmigo está, puedo oír su voz, y que suyo dice, seré, en el canto que halló en el ahí, con nadie tener podré. It's this beautiful song. I would hear them singing it, just being with God, cleaning the house. These are women who were widows. These were women who had trauma. One of them raised children in the fields, 9 kids working the fields. Can you imagine? The other one had 3 husbands, all died. She's raising 7 kids by herself, and yet how is it that their grandchild is watching them just be with God and find healing and just wanting other people to know about Jesus? And I couldn't understand, and they didn't know I was going through trauma, but I knew the trauma they had gone through, and yet they were finding freedom and healing and singing these beautiful songs of being in the garden with God alone. They were not in distress. They were not worried about tomorrow. They didn't have any riches. They had little apartments that we couldn't even all fit if the whole family came over. And yet they found healing in the garden with God. And I think that's what God wants with us, is just to kind of walk with us and be with us. And sometimes our trauma becomes the outfit we wear to keep God at a distance. And I wonder if we took off, as hard as it may be, as the process lingers to take off, to disrobe the trauma, to be with God, what could really happen? Now, Merle left out these lines in his version, but it leads us to point number 3. He says, I'd stay in the garden with him, though the night around me be falling, but he bids me go through the voice of woe. His voice to me is calling. Now, wouldn't it be nice if you believe in God to like just hang out with other people who love Jesus and sing, listen to music all day long and have fun with people who are just wanting to grow and read scripture? Wouldn't that just be amazing for some of us? But it's more than that. See, we are called to take our healing and take it to the world. We are called to bring love and joy, to love everyone life by life. That's what we're called to do, because it's not just about being with God. It's also being a conduit and being used by God to go. And God, number 3, gives Gideon instructions. Verse 25, that same night the Lord said to him, take down the bull from your father's herd, the one who's 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to Baal. So they would build these altars and they would burn things on them to gods. And so this other god was called Baal. And he's telling him to tear it down. There are no other gods before me. He says, then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on top of this height. And using the wood of the Asherah pole, basically it's a pole and an altar that really commemorate other gods. Tear down that pole and offer a second bull as a burnt offering. So Gideon took 10 of his servants and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the townspeople, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. You ever have God tell you something, or you feel you should do something, but you don't do it in front of other people because you're afraid of what people are going to think? I don't know. He obeyed, but he did it at night. Go and sacrifice a bull. I know we would never do that today. That was pretty normal in Old Testament times. It was a sign of honoring God. Go and sacrifice the bull too. Tear down the altars and the idols to other gods. Rebuild a new altar. And number 4, go public with me. By doing this, you are going public with me. You know, later today, in between our first and second service and after our second service, we have people who've given their lives to Christ and they're going public with their faith. They are going to be baptized. They're going to say, I'm taking my next step in Jesus. And we're going to celebrate them. And that is what God is asking of Gideon. I want you to go public with what I am calling you to do. The question on this one is this: how am I instructing or empowering those around me? And that's a question that we wrestle with as parents. My wife and I wrestle with that. Are we giving enough instruction? Are we guiding enough? And some of us in the room, we're new to this whole faith thing, and we're like, I'm not really doing that. I don't even know how to do that. But I want you to know you're not alone in this. But we are called to give instruction. Can you imagine if you gave your kids some money and said, hey, just use this money for whatever you need for back to school? I don't know about your kids, but my kids would come back with a lot of things and still need everything for back to school. Because you have to give instructions. Hey, just make sure you take this list of supplies that your teachers are giving you, buy everything on this list. Here's what you basically need: some jeans, some shorts, some t-shirts, blah, blah, blah. Oh, here's your list. Outside of that, do what you want with it. Well, Dad, it's not enough money. Make it work. Just make it work. And how many times do we send our kids, ourselves, our loved ones into a world without any clear instruction, without any kind of help? And yet God was with Gideon. He gave him instructions. And I'm telling you, there's some of us here, and many of us here, that we haven't connected anywhere here at Gateway quite yet. And as one of your pastors, I want to let you know, we're called to be in community. Find a class, a group, something. Because number four is this: God uses others. God uses others. So Gideon goes and he tears down the altar. He tears down the pole. He rebuilds it. He's doing everything he knows to do. And then everybody sees what he did. Everybody sees what happens. And now people are trying to figure out, who's the one who tore down the altar? Who's the one who tore down the pole? Who's the one who tore down everything to the god Baal? And people turned on him. Verse 29, comes to find out that Gideon, son of Joash, did it. And the people of the town demanded of Joash, bring out your son. He must die because he has broken down Baal's altars. How many times will you break down something that your family loves, that you know is not healthy, that you know is evil, that God is calling you to break a generational curse of sorts, like John was talking about last week? And you think your family is going to like it? Absolutely not. They were coming after Gideon. But Joash, his dad, replied to the hostile crowd, are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? And what he's trying to do is he's trying to save his son. And let me tell you what's beautiful about this picture of Joash trying to save his son, is that the same dad who created a culture in the home that allowed Gideon to not have confidence, the same dad who had a home that taught his son that he was the least, the same dad who had a home, that when God showed up to Gideon, Gideon was like, you've abandoned us, is the same dad that was there for his son. The same father who created a culture in the home that damaged Gideon, God used that same man to defend Gideon. And all the naysayers, we live in a culture where we're trying to cancel everybody. We live in a culture where if they don't agree with me, I'm not going to listen. We live in a culture of, you think this, I can't be your friend. We live in that culture. And yet for Gideon, these people that were against him, that wanted to kill him, God used his enemies. Why? Because they came to him and they gave him a new name. He was no longer called Gideon. He was now called Jerubbaal, the one who contends with Baal. Don't you think that was honoring to God? That Gideon's name now was the one who's against those who are against God. I haven't liked all of my development as a pastor. I haven't liked all of my experiences. I have worked for some amazing people, and I've worked for people that, God bless them, I'm just praying for them. I've led some amazing people, and I've led some people that, God bless them. And yet, it's all part of our experience. if we will allow God to be in the middle of it. God uses people. Parent question on this is this: who in our life is helping us develop and shape our children? Helping us develop and shape our marriage, our financial life, our spiritual life. You know, we have hundreds of people at Gateway who give of their time and their energy and their gifting to make sure that you and your teenagers and your children are cared for. Because you're not alone. You don't have to do this by yourself. We do have student pastors, but we have a ton of volunteers, and we need more. We do have kids directors, but we need more than that. We need people to step up to help us care and love and shape one another's children. I was at camp this summer, and to see leaders step up and just make a difference and play games and give up their PTO that they worked really hard for to pour into your teenager, to pour into your kid. I saw college students. I saw 50-year-olds, 60, now I don't know if we have any 60-year-olds. 50-year-olds, I think there's like a cutoff. If you're 60, I don't know if you can go to camp. But we'd love to have you next year, right? Like, we saw all these people make a difference in teenagers and pray over them. The last night of camp, to see all these leaders just be with kids one-on-one and believe with them and pray God's blessing over them. It marked so many of our teenagers. You don't have to do this alone. You're not made to do this alone. But my question is, who is helping you? Let us help you. It's more than John or myself or Eric as we speak on the weekends. It's about our staff. It's about hundreds of volunteers. It's about people who will be friends with you in groups. Together, God uses us to shape one another. I heard a quote, not sure how lined up it is theologically, but it made me think about it. It said this: no one can replace what Jesus did on the cross. He's the only one who can bring redemption and salvation. And yet God uses people not for salvation, but to bring complete healing. And sometimes the thing we avoid, people, is the gift that God wants to give us. The gift of relationship, the gift of ironing, sharpening iron, the gift of somebody praying and believing with us. Because if you've been through things like I've been through things, I can't find healing by myself. I need others. You need others. And what others do when they're healthy is they bring you back to God. As a pastor, we get to hear a lot of these stories. And what we talk about these weeks is what we do every single day: helping people understand their story, helping people understand where they are, helping people really wrestle through how God wants to use them and go back and understand their family, understand their past, understand their hurts, understand all these things. We have people who do this every single week. This isn't a series. At our campuses, we have people who are trained, not just staff, but volunteers, who spend time doing this every single day to bring healing to people. But I want you to know, as a pastor, we get to walk with people in their highs, and we get to cry with them in their lows. We get to ask them tough questions, and we get to have great conversations. What we're doing last week and this week and next week is not just a fun little series, because it's not fun at all. What we're doing is we're saying we're with you in this, not just from a stage, but at every campus. We have people wanting to love you, wanting to be with you. Why? Because if we're willing to be with you, it's a reflection that God is being with you, that God desires to be with you. So as we sing this song, God's ever-loving presence with us, I want you to think about that. Think about the thing that burst your bubble, or the things that burst your bubble. And ask yourself, am I willing to give these things back to God, the one who desires to be with me through this process? Let's sing.